Yeah, at the end of the game, of course, you can have shots on you. Like a bird, you're going to be free to fly. Then you really better set yourself for no shots. And with everything you've got inside, you want to jump back.
Measured in many ways, against millions of years of evolution, thousands of years of history, or the heartbeats of a single life. This program considers the question, what time is it, in terms of the nuclear age, through prophecy of a world near its end, as an hour on the atomic scientist's clock with minutes left before midnight, as a stage in the arms race between the superpowers, and even as the darkness before the dawn of a new age. Chumash Indian storyteller Shukwish Aho'o begins with a story about the migration of human beings through this, the fourth world. The Hopi story tells about the three previous worlds. In each one, the people had come to a place of high technology that went out of balance. And this imbalance caused the earth to wash herself clean. The end of the third world, people went underground and survived. One day, from their longing, they joined their prayers together and called up to the creator of the great mystery. Masao, the messenger, came and led them out of the earth onto the land again, and divided the people and sent them into four directions. And to each people, the messenger gave a portion of the great truth. And the people went into each of the four directions, carrying their portion of the truth. This migration took a very long time. Some returned and some became lost as they began to think with the passage of time that they had the only truth, or perhaps the greatest truth. They became defenders and began to build fortresses around their truth. They began to fight wars and create religions to protect their truth. And the sacred hoop of the nations was broken. When the sacred hoop of the nations was broken, once again the Hopi say, this would bring about a time of great chaos, and that it would then be followed by the time of purification. The purification could come by way of the technology of destruction, bringing out a gourd of ashes that would make the seas boil and destroy all human life as we know it. Or the purification would come about by a reforming, a mending of the sacred hoop, and then we would step into the fifth world as a time of harmony, balance, and peace.
This Hopi story suggests that while our technology may be greater than our wisdom, we still have a choice between coexistence and non-existence. On the one hand, the technologies of mass destruction continue to advance in their deadly sophistication and their proliferation around the globe. On the other hand, the current political climate offers hope, with arms negotiations between the superpowers continuing and wars on several continents coming to an end. what time is it? Will the human migration through the fourth world end with our self-extinction? Or with our evolution into a planetary people, able to bring our portions of the truth together within the great hoop of life? At a forum which posed the question, what time is it? Environmentalist David Brower spoke about what time is and how much time we have left.
I'm certainly enchanted with the definition you all know about time. It was what was invented to keep everything from happening at once. And the other thing is that we don't quite realize that time never began and won't end. It just goes on. It's just our limits that require us to have time. And just, I guess, a week ago in San Francisco, I was asked a question, Drake, well, how much time do we have left? Well, I said that I thought that if we kept going the way we're going, about the year 2020 would finish us off. But then I thought that night, well, it's 30 years maybe, but maybe 30 minutes, because we reached the great ascendancy of technology where with just another computer mistake or two that is not corrected in time, that's it. The world as we know it could be over if a computer error is made in Moscow or in Washington. Now, 30 minutes from now, the world as we know it is finished.
In the cover of the bulletin of the atomic scientists, there is a clock. And when things look more favorable for disarmament or slowing down the nuclear arms race or things generally look more favorable for peace, then the clock is moved back. And if there's a lot of tension and bad feelings between the nuclear powers and things begin to look tense, well, then the clock is moved forward towards midnight. Ever got to midnight, you see, that would be when the world was coming to an end or nuclear war had broken out or something like that.
Ray Kidder is a physicist at Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, where he has been doing nuclear weapons research for more than 30 years. He gives his opinion on which way the hands of the clock are moving at this time.
I would be inclined to be moving the hands backward, not forward, simply because of the much more cooperative and more peaceful, shall we say, aspect of the Soviet Union and in particular Gorbachev. I mean, I think that's made a difference. As far as the American public is concerned, the events that have been taking place in the Soviet Union have the effect of relieving tensions. I mean, nobody can be as worried that Soviet Union is going to launch an attack on us tomorrow, as he might have been a few years ago.
Many people believe that the INF Treaty, reducing intermediate nuclear forces, and the negotiations towards a START treaty that might eliminate 50% of the superpower's strategic arsenals, have ended the present danger of nuclear war. Others maintain that additional measures are needed to keep our world from drifting toward catastrophe.
I don't think that the very fact that we're in negotiation with the Soviets makes as much difference to the risk of nuclear war as the public supposes.
Daniel Ellsberg is a peace activist who formerly worked as a strategic analyst for the Pentagon.
I think the arms control talks that have gone on since late 1981 have been almost exclusively for the purpose of demobilizing public concern and public resistance to the arms race. I think in Reagan's case, and the officials closest to him, that was quite explicitly in their own minds, cynically, privately, the exclusive purpose of such a negotiation, and that they were designed and shaped only to undercut public anxiety and public mobilization. I think the public is unduly reassured by the fact that talks are going on. And the Reagan administration learned that and used it. And I don't see yet Bush going beyond the limited response that Reagan made.
The negotiations, first of all, beginning with the INF Treaty, is a start of doing something. It's a positive thing to do, even though the number of weapons that are involved is a very small part of the total. What you're doing, I think, is trying to build confidence between adversaries so they won't feel that they need to have these weapons. That's the key thing. Because if you see that the other guy hasn't got anything to damage you with, you're going to say, hey, if he doesn't have it, I guess maybe he doesn't want to damage me. You see, and that's the sort of element of trust that builds on itself. So the cycle can either spiral up or it can spiral down, and hopefully we're in the downward part of that spiral now.
Dr. Christine Castle, former president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, thinks that the recent INF treaty, and even a START treaty, may not halt a continuing upward spiral in the arms race.
What could potentially happen, even with a START agreement in place, is that the weapons they'll get rid of will be the old obsolete weapons, and the ones that they'll keep will be the first strike weapons, which are weapons intended to destroy the other guy's missiles, and which are destabilizing because their only benefit is if they're used first. There's nothing in a START agreement that says anything about getting rid of first strike weapons. The second thing it doesn't do is get rid of weapons in space, which are part of the SDI myth. I mean, SDI was sold to the American public as a defensive system. But once you get those kinds of laser-based systems and other kinds of satellite interceptors in space, they can be used just as easily offensively as defensively, so that those kinds of weapons are exceedingly destructive and would not be destroyed under the START agreement. And then finally, the production of plutonium and highly enriched uranium that continues to go on. These are the most toxic substances known to man, and the production of this kind of material goes on because people are expecting to build more weapons. And if we were to cut down the numbers of warheads by 50% and not cut down the production of plutonium, it would be real evidence that the intent is not to reduce real destructive capability, but simply to give the illusion of it.
I don't think these negotiations would be taking place in the sense that both parties were conspiring simply to fool their own constituencies and say, hey, look, this is just a good chance to get rid of obsolete weapons. I don't feel that's the case. Because in the agreements that you make, each side is going to try to make sure that the other side gets rid of not his obsolete weapons, but the ones he really relies on. For example, we are talking about, in the START agreements, getting the Soviet Union to eliminate these heavy ICBMs with a very large number of mullable warheads on them. Well, those certainly are not their obsolete weapons. That's the front line of their nuclear force. But I think the most important part of all this is this confidence-building sort of principle. And that's what's going to make peace.
Simply reducing the numbers of nuclear weapons does not build Dr. Castle's confidence that peace is in the making. She believes that without a comprehensive test ban, the arms race and the danger of nuclear war will continue.
People have to realize that the way to stop this thing is to stop modernization, and that that's what a comprehensive test ban is about. We now know, because of the work of our scientific colleagues, that it's verifiable, that we can stop all nuclear testing, and that the Soviets will go along with it. So I think it's the obvious way to go about stopping increasing threats of destructive capability.
Daniel Ellsberg believes that the greatest threat of nuclear warfare comes from regional conflicts, where the superpowers do not directly confront each other.
As nuclear weapons get more widely distributed, which is happening at a very rapid rate right now, conflicts that don't involve superpowers or great powers also offer military contingents and opportunities to use these. Proliferation seems to have occurred, the kind that we've been warned about for many years, in terms now of Pakistan as well as Israel, South Africa, probably, or as being very close in Argentina and Brazil, and a number of other places. So any one of them involved in regional conflicts could well make the kinds of threats that the U.S. has made in the past and find themselves, in some case, carrying them out. Once that precedent occurs, I think that will open floodgates for nuclear weapons becoming relatively common in limited wars, regional wars. We've not even seen, I think, an era of limited nuclear war. But they will all have the potential for exploit and unlimited catastrophic war that destroys the most life in the northern hemisphere, possibly the most life on Earth.
are nations of people committing suicide. It boggles my comprehension. It is so frightening. And there isn't much time. It is the 11th hour. If the sacred hoop and the sacred cycles of life are broken, then it begins to die. And when the circle dies, it carries all life into this world. And now we must take responsibility that that life will continue for ourselves and others. And so it's a consecration of oneself, a discovery of consciousness, and a discovery of responsibility, and now to act on that. And only in the acting upon, the remembering, the turning around, the recognizing each other, will we create a wave that will cleanse the earth in a right way.
How can we mend the broken circle? What actions might we take to make our world truly secure and protect the continuity of life? Speakers in this program recommend different ways to reach this goal. These include national leadership, renewed activism, and the building of a multiracial movement. Dr. Castle prescribes a new set of priorities for the United States, for it is her view that in today's world, restoring our economic health is more important than building up our military might.
It is a reality of the modern world that the United States is no longer the dominant economic force in the world. It is also a reality of the world that nuclear weapons cannot make us more strong militarily, that they make us more vulnerable militarily. So Americans are going to have to come to terms with this and realize that the way that we have to be strong then is to rebuild our economic base. More than 50% of American scientists and engineers now work in military development. We can't be putting all of our finest scientific minds, resources, both money and human resources, into more and more arcane and destructive weapons at a time when our competitors in the global economy, Japan and Germany and other countries, are putting all their best minds into developing things which can be bought and sold on the open market and which improve the quality of life of their own citizens and those of people throughout the world. So if we were to take the brain power and put it into rebuilding our own industrial base, we'll be in a much stronger position in terms of our own national security than if we continue to let our internal strength erode while we build up mountains of destructive hardware around our perimeter.
I think what is crucially important is leadership.
Ray Kidder is a physicist at Lawrence Livermore Laboratories.
Because, as everybody knows, if you have a country with a couple hundred million people or 20 million or whatever, they're busy doing things. They're not thinking so much about the big picture. Most people don't think about that at all. But people do follow leaders. Look at the way they followed Hitler. That's a bad example, but I think there's an element of luck to that, too, because if you have an important leader that comes around, I think Gorbachev is the current example of a remarkable person that has come to the fore. He can change the whole picture. And so there is sort of an accidental, almost, aspect to what happens to us humans here, depending on the appearance or non-appearance of very fine leaders.
I don't see the Bush administration finding in itself the determination or the ability to respond adequately to the overtures and the changes that are being posed by the Soviet Union right now.
Daniel Ellsberg.
That will take a movement to this country to demand that these openings and opportunities for a real change in the international order and a change toward peace and away from nuclear be seized. Every kind of activity, political activity, I think of the kind that has brought major changes in the past, is needed on this issue. And that means a certain electoral activity, lobbying, letter writing, demonstrations, and I would say also nonviolent civil disobedience. As Gandhi found and Martin Luther King found, nonviolent civil disobedience is a powerful tactic. It has a way of speaking to the consciences of other people that does get them to who examine their lives and their relation to these existing evils in a way that rhetoric that's unaccompanied by commitment or action, like courage or risk, doesn't do. So I think we need every bit of organization and more, and civil disobedience and every other method, to overcome the passivity and the inertia and the skepticism and the resistance to change that we're seeing in our own country, that is our own government.
I've been able to find and work with a lot of people of all colors who are understanding the absolute necessity of building a multicultural and multiracial movement in this country.
Diane Thomas is an ecumenical peace activist.
Those of us who are white, we grow up, we look around and people in charge of the banks are white and people in charge of every major institution in this country are white, and particularly white males. And so we look in the mirror and we see a white person, we just assume that we should be in charge, that we should be in control. But my understanding is that by the year 2000, 90% of the people in the world will be non-white. You know, this is, you know, for people who maybe don't even want to have an open heart, at least vested self-interest should make us understand that we need to make common cause with people of color. And a friend of mine told me recently that an American Indian friend, that in his understanding of his people, that we were in a time of the bitter wind. And I asked him, how do we turn the bitter wind around? Who's going to turn the bitter wind around? And he said, those who know. And I would say that, you know, what time it is the bitter wind. The way we're going to turn it around is by working with people of all cultures and all races and all nations in an egalitarian way, and that is no small task.
For different peoples everywhere to work together, we need to pull the curtains that divide our world into enemy camps. This will take a global recognition of our common humanity and a respect for each other's portions of the truth.
We have, I think, much too limited a sense of family kinship with other humans. And to come to see humanity not only as one species, but as, in a broad sense, one family, is, I think, a very important change in consciousness that is possible in the modern era with the modern communications that we have, and very important. But really, that sense of kinship has to go beyond even humanity. We have to change the notion that we are the privileged species and the stewards, even, let alone the dominators, of other species and of the earth as a whole. And I think the sense of a global identity in which we feel a real interdependence with and common fate and common concern for not only all other forms of life, but the non-living constituents that life depends on, the air and the water. I think that's a change and extension of identity that is called for if we're to transcend not only war, but the kind of ecological depredation now that is threatening life as much as war does and as much as nuclear weapons do.
Human beings in the indigenous view are only a part of the wheel. And they are a part of the wheel. It is a great and wonderful thing to be a part of the cycle of life. How wonderful to think of yourself as related to the swiftness, delicacy, and beauty of the deer. How wonderful to be able to call aunt and uncle the power and the might and the protective energy of the bear. How wonderful to think as a sister, the snake, which lives with its belly lying on the sacred earth. When we say all of our relations, homet dakriyasi, is the way the Sioux would say it. It means that all that we do as human beings must be done in a right way so that it serves and honors all of our relations. And all of our relations are not only our family and our friends and our nations of two-legged, but all the Earth's people. It means our relationship with the winged ones, the four-legged ones, the creepy crawlies, the stone people, the watery ways, the highest mountain, and the grain of sand. That we must be able to say as we go through life, I walk in right relation. I speak in right relation. I do in right relation.
Do you really want to be a part of the solution? We want no more. We need to be another peaceful revolution. Banana knocking at your door.
What Time Is It is a Fine Line production, produced by Claire Schoen, written by Stephen Most, recorded by Claire Schoen, Ralph Steiner, and Lisa Ginsberg. Theme song written and performed by Chick Streetman. Additional music by Fernando Celicion and R. Carlos Nakai. Special thanks to Claire Greensfelder and the 3220 Gallery. Participants in this program are all contributors to the recently published book entitled The Broken Circle, A Search for Wisdom in the Nuclear Age. The Broken Circle is available through Consulting Psychologist Press in Palo Alto, California. This program was funded through a grant by New Lambda Trust. I'm Kate McLaughlin.
Yeah.